And welcome everyone to the 9th annual R.D. Watt Lecture. My name is Dr. Angela Patterson and I'm a research scientist in the School of Life and Environmental Sciences and a member of the Sydney Institute of Agriculture. It's my honour to be presenting this lecture here today on the eve of International Women's Day. Before we begin the proceedings, I would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the traditional owners on the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is upon their ancestral lands that the University of Sydney is built. As we share our knowledge, teaching, learning and research practices within this university, may we also pay respect to the knowledge embedded forever within the Aboriginal custodianship of country. The annual R.D. Watt Lecture commemorates the first lecture delivered to University of Sydney agriculture students right back in March 1911 by Australia's first Professor and Dean of Agriculture, Robert Dickey Watt. Professor Watt developed courses with a strong scientific content which became characteristic of the Sydney agriculture degree. Interestingly, the first female students began only a few years after this, in 1917. Lorna Byrne, later Hayter, and Margaret Ramsey, later Brebner, the first two graduates are pictured here outside the iconic R.D. Watt building in academic dress. But this image is probably more appropriate. It shows Lorna, Margaret and another female student on an excursion at Gerringong in 1919. True aggers with their sleeves rolled up and extra points for navigating a field trip in a skirt. That's a notable achievement in itself. There are several famous women in agriculture from Australia's history. We all know Elizabeth MacArthur, and there are many more. But R.D. Watt and his colleagues include within their incredible legacy as training the first female agricultural scientists and starting to build the vital role of women in STEM. The annual R.D. Watt Lecture is presented by the Sydney Institute of Agriculture, which provides world-leading cutting-edge research and outreach for agricultural innovation, business and policy. Our research structure is built on five thematic research areas: plant breeding and production, carbon, water and soil, quality food, animal agriculture and development agriculture. This multidisciplinary research coalesces around the concepts of digital transformation, profitability, resilience, provenance, and connectivity. The Institute is a multidisciplinary research institute with a presence in multiple locations, including Sydney, Camden, and Narrabri, with representation all around the world. And on that note, Professor McBratney asked me to frame tonight's lecture with a few words on what I do as a research scientist at the University's Narrabri campus, which is about 7 hours' drive northwest of here, depending on how much traffic there is on Pennant Hills Road. I'm a plant breeder and researcher specialising in abiotic stress tolerance. This is my office. It's got great air conditioning, ergonomic stand-up workspace and excellent views. So who would want a corner office when this is available? On the left are chickpea field plots, of which I had over 2,000 last year to describe and quantify for heat tolerance as part of the Legumes for Sustainable Agriculture Hub. It was about a half a kilometre walk from one corner of the field to the other, so perhaps it was also one of the biggest offices in the university. The image on the right is Lara Farm, which is up at Narrabri and the site of the DigiFarm project, as well as millions of dollars of commercial and research projects for the university, many of them industry funded. It includes a project investigating the productivity of native grasslands, featured in the front, including Aboriginal food production methods, and comparing these to the modern high-tech crop production shown in the distance in the image. My career story has been a very positive one, and before this lecture, to be honest, I hadn't given much thought as to how being a woman made my experience unique, and perhaps this is because it is not that unique anymore. I graduated in a generation where roughly 45% of agriculture graduates are female, and roughly 50% of my work colleagues today are female, even in this field-based role. These are some of the women I work with up at Narrabri. Great people in a range of technical and academic roles. You'll find people driving forklifts, using the hydraulic soil corer, driving tractors, driving headers, and it's all completely normal. The staff work together as a team to get jobs done, and there's plenty to do to stay ahead of the climate, rapidly changing industry, growing global population, all the things that we work on together. And we mostly achieve our goals. To be fair to my male colleagues, I probably should have also included some photos of women arguing with temperamental GPS guidance systems and letting out a few choice word malfunctioning lab equipment, because not everyone smiles like this all the time. I grew up in the city, but I now live in the country and have married into a country family. And I'd say that based on my experience, country people seem to be a bit ahead of their city colleagues in terms of acceptance of women doing traditionally male roles, particularly at certain times of year, aka the busy ones. Statistically, women make up around 32% of Australia's agricultural workforce, and that includes roles in agribusiness, innovation, government policy, ethical governance, etc., as well as the roles on the land. However, on a family farm, it's not that unusual for a female to feed the stock, maintain the fences, drive a chaser bin to harvest hundreds of hectares. Everyone just pitches in to get the job done. And this is hard to capture in official statistics. Any farming family can tell you that when you are far away from population centres and it's a busy time, everyone just gets stuck in. There's no difference. This is not really that different to the field-based science projects that I work on, where we just focus on getting the job done and don't really think that much about gender roles in the team. When the sun is shining, the plants won't stop for anything. And more importantly, the world urgently needs the productivity and sustainability answers that we are trying to find. Perhaps this is a lesson that field-based agriculture can teach the sectors that struggle to build diverse workforces. When just getting the job done consumes one's focus, we are more likely to accept the diverse ways that people approach tasks because the end results are very fruitful. Yes, the pun was intended. So tonight, as we hear from three amazing speakers, can I encourage us to look at tonight not as an unusual celebration of a minority, but just another exciting instalment that honours the legacy of Aarti Watt helping to build a strong, educated agriculture industry. So with that, I am delighted to introduce three leaders in agriculture and University of Sydney alumni to share insights into their work, what they think the future holds for Australian agriculture, and how women continue to be key contributors. Caroline Wardrop graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture, Honours 2, Division 1, in 2003. Lucinda Corrigan graduated from the University of Sydney with a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture, Honours 1, in 1981. However, our first speaker this evening is Evie Murdoch. Evie Murdoch graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture, Honours 1, and the University Medal in 2016. Evie is a Senior Agribusiness Consultant at KPMG Australia, and has been working across the agribusiness sector, where she is passionate about meaningful, innovative change. Most recently, she has worked with the National Farmers Federation, co-authoring their $100 billion industry plan. Please join me in welcoming Evie Murdoch.
Thank you. Oh, I have the tough job of going first. So I have a couple of pretty pictures to help start it off. So the first kind of question we were asked to reflect on was why agriculture and where the passion? So I thought I would start at the very beginning. So keeping in mind that at 24, I don't really feel like I've come that far, my love of agriculture started out when I was very, very young, with a love of cows, riding motorbikes, and the family farm at Glenfallock in Holbrook, New South Wales. When I was little, Glenfallock was run by my grandfather and now by my uncle, both two extremely passionate men who care a lot about the land they run and the food they produce. So if not for a family history in agriculture, then I looked to school, where I studied ag as a subject from year 9 to year 12. It was pretty exciting to go to a school in the middle of Sydney where we had an ag campus, or an ag plot as we called it, and an ag subject that we could study. I remember being told by my careers counsellor in year 10 that I should probably consider dropping ag as it wasn't going to take me anywhere and wouldn't help my marks. I hope I'm still proving him wrong. I was lucky enough to go to school that had an ag plot in the heart of Sydney, where we used to look after three probably very lonely sheep, a number of goats that loved escaping, and a lot of chickens. But my favourite part of our ag plot was actually our veggie patch. I loved the variety of produce that we could make in the middle of a little plot of dirt at the back of school. I remember one year we planted potatoes, and soon quickly learnt that if you plant potatoes, you will probably only grow potatoes for a long time after that, as everything else we planted came out as potatoes. I guess I could say that was where my love for veggies started. So jumping ahead and telling another little anecdote, my love of veggie gardens continued for a long time after that, and I was very proud of the veggie patch I had in the front yard of my childhood home. About 6 months after selling said childhood home, though, I walked right back into the front garden, harvested all the veggies from the veggie patch, and took them home for myself. I was very proud of my veggies. Mum was less so. So despite these silly stories and family experiences and childhood adventures, my school years and childhood were pivotal in shaping my views around agriculture. It's complex, and food is really important. A lot of people don't realise that. And while that's probably pretty basic to tell an audience such as yourselves who are attending an ag lecture, it's something that drives me still in my day-to-day job. We need to continue to feed a growing population with less. It's going to be hard. We need to produce better, grow better, trade better, process better, package better, and waste better. We need to feed the world better. So, what did I do about it? I studied ag. So I first started studying here in 2013 at what was then the Faculty of Ag and Environment on a merit scholarship, and I was pretty glad that I pursued it. I had a group of classmates and professors who were inspiring. They shared a vision similar to mine. We became friends for life and had a couple of unique experiences along the way, and I'm pretty grateful for the ag community and the faculty for driving me towards what I still do today. I had some pretty cool experiences while studying. There were numerous field trips from Dubbo to Cooma, Narrabri, and of course Camden. A few of my friends from uni are still, not still here today, they came here today, and we were reflecting on these earlier. We had some pretty funny stories to tell. We also had quite a reputation as an ag cohort, and I'm sure if you came to uni here, you probably know what I'm talking about. Ag was pretty fun, and I'm glad for the memories that we made as friends. I got to help organise three fantastic ag balls while I was here as part of the Ag Society, and I'll never forget the look on the Dean's face when he was told that the University of Sydney sacred jacaranda tree had fallen down on the same night as ag ball. In my last year of study here, I undertook an honours thesis in looking at growing small-scale veggie patches in home gardens as part of an investigation into how we could better produce food for low socioeconomic populations, and to look at the ability of grow your own gardens as such to provide not only nutritional benefits but health and social benefits too. The work was pretty close to my heart as it bridged my interests between urban and rural, city, food and ag issues. My analyses looked at comparing the total ability of a garden 1 metre squared by 1 metre to produce food at a comparable price to supermarket vegetables. I looked at the ability of each of these small modules to economically provide a source of fresh food for home consumption and showed that how I could deliver valuable nutrition at a cost less than what you could buy it for at a supermarket. Some of my modules showed that even with the cost of production factored in, you could save up to $250 a year. And for someone living in a low socioeconomic population, that's quite a lot of money. I was interviewed about my work by Costa on Gardening Australia, be here, and approached by the City of Sydney Council to investigate my work further. So you can still watch the episode on iView if you'd like to see. So you can see that my love of veggies didn't quite fade. But what about now? I think I've got a pretty unique position to talk about here. I only have had a short career. I've been out of uni for 2 years. Hasn't been that long. I first worked at Ruralco, an agribusiness listed on the ASX, as part of my placement requirements for uni. In fact, Damien, you might remember marking said placement portfolio. And I stayed on with Ruralco for another 18 months where I was given opportunities to work across their business development team and their marketing, comms and corporate affairs teams, both two really unique and different parts of their business. And I'm grateful for the break that RuralCo gave me, and I cracked the industry. The people I got to meet and the places I got to go was pretty exciting. Now, I find myself working in a rather different workplace at KPMG, one of the largest professional services and accounting firms in the world. Most people don't even realise that KPMG has a food and ag team. Working at KPMG in our team has been a really eye-opening experience. The ag industry is shifting and evolving rapidly, and the reach that ag has extended far beyond the paddock due to our digitally connected and demanding population. Tech, innovation and the internet, coupled with better funding for research and investment, are fast becoming the most relied upon methods of driving productivity, profitability and the ag industry itself. The industry is becoming more than farming and more than the plate of food in front of you, and I'm excited to continue to work in that space. At KPMG, I've had the pleasure of working across a multitude of sectors, both public and private, for a range of different clients. I've helped them write strategies, such as the National Farmers Federation's Talking 2030 paper on driving industry value to $100 billion in the next 10 to 11 years. I've written investment cases, reorganised supply chains, planned for innovation, and for what is already the inevitable, a future totally connected by blockchain. Now I'm busy driving client work on looking at food provenance and traceability throughout the supply chain through digital enabling software tools such as the Internet of Things. But I still get to draw upon my ag science skills on a daily basis, interacting with farmers, supply chain players, retailers and food traders. I can now say that I have a knowledge across a wide range of the industry. I know about airports, logistics, food trade, intensive production, horticulture, extensive production systems, dairy, ag tech, water efficiency, drought management. All of these things are part of my day-to-day job. You name it, I live it, or I'm learning it, or I hope to. I get to be at the forefront of a forward-focused, consumer-centric industry. And every day I get to work with a team of people that are truly helping to do ag better, to feed better. I've been privileged to work with some phenomenal clients to date, and I can't wait to see what work really throws at me next. And if I had to sum up the ag industry from my work perspective, then it's opportunity. It's opportunity to continue to drive the industry towards better. We don't need to produce more food necessarily, we just need to produce it better. And I guess I thought I'd throw in something a little on the side. It's not all ag for me, I have another job too. I get to teach gym classes at Fitness First, which I really enjoy, giving back to the community and striving to improve the health of more people. And I apologise to my criminal and civil law lecturer, whose lecture I'm missing tonight to be here, as I undertake a Juris Doctor. ETA, finish time, 2025. Hold that thought. So what about the future? I see the future of ag not as one that is clouded in doom and gloom, despite what the press might sometimes say. Sure, there are some things that are a little scary. The climate is shifting, you can't deny that. The population is rising, food demand increasing, and the land with which we have to grow food and produce food decreasing. But above all, I see potential and hope, and I hope there's a role in there for me to help realise that. More and more, people are starting to question where their food has come from. Where was it grown? How was it grown? What's in it? How is it processed? How did it get to me? Personally, these are the things that fascinate me, and I hope that I can learn to understand and demonstrate that more. I see as an industry, we're going to be challenged to evidence how we made things, how we grew it, how we packaged it, how we disposed of it. More and more, the supply chain is going to demand these things from us in real time and free of charge to the end consumer as a matter of simple, basic social license to operate. These things pose unique challenges and conundrums for our sector, and also for the producers and the farmers who are pivotal to it. I hope that the work that I can do can help contribute to solutions for these problems and drive the industry towards that total goal of $100 billion of farm gate output in the next 11 years. I hope that as part of my job, I can be part of this driving productivity effectively, efficiently, but also and above all, sustainably. a better ability to forward propel ourselves collaboratively, as a group, as a team, to reduce industry duplication, prevent solution dilution and copycat systems, to better link research and consultancy work, such as what I do, with the everyday lives of the on-farm reality of farming. The bottom line here is primary producers need to drive food sustainability and productivity, but we can help them benefit from innovation and industry development on our side of the desk too. I can use my knowledge on farm as well as my work off farm to drive the true potential of innovation for the industry. So, as a final comment and some final pretty pictures, I was incredibly proud to be asked to speak tonight and to reflect a little bit on why I chose ag, why I followed my industry, and where I see the future of the industry going. I've often attended these lectures as a student, rather in awe of the people who get to speak, the things they've done, and the great leaders that they are, such as the other women who are going to speak after me, Caroline and Lucinda. These women have most certainly done great things. The women I work with and train with at the gym, these women have also done great things. It's these women that inspire me. Although I don't think that I have yet done great things, I sure hope one day that I too will be able to say that I am a leader and that I have done great things. That maybe I might inspire someone else too. Choose food. Choose ag. This industry has come so far, but it has a long way to go. I think that the field we're working in is balancing as well. As a future leader, sex aside, I hope that I can encourage others to follow my footsteps. Courage, persistence, and determination help too. But for now, this concrete cowgirl, as a lot of my friends call me, will keep making hay while the sun shines, but from the office, not the paddock. I'm going to keep putting my best self forward, take opportunities when they come, and keep moving in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Evie. Our next speaker this evening is Caroline Wardrop. Caroline is an agricultural policy specialist and has spent the majority of her career working for the Australian Government, delivering policy relating to natural resource management, soil, water infrastructure, meat and livestock animal exports, and Australian agricultural and veterinary chemicals. Caroline is currently seconded to the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet to review the Australian Public Service. Please welcome Caroline Wardrop.
I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners on the land on which we meet today, the Gadigal people, and pay my respects to the elders past and present. I'd also like to thank Professor Alex McBratney for asking me to speak at today's event. It is a real honour to be recognised as a female leader, and I hope that I can provide some food for thought for everyone here today and some insights into what can be achieved by studying in this important field. So where did my journey begin? Well, I've always been fascinated with animals and the natural world. And even at 5 months old, that's me as the baby, I was intrigued. And this was further encouraged as a young child, spending my Easter holidays in the New South Wales Central West, riding horses, chasing cattle, catching yabbies, hunting for eggs, and just generally roaming free in the Australian bush. As a teenager, I spent my school days holed up in a concrete jungle, but my weekends competing at agricultural shows around the Greater Sydney Basin. I was one very spoilt child and can proudly profess to being then and now a horsey girl. While I had dreams of being a vet as a young girl, I was a little bit too lazy at school to get the marks. But I'm quite thankful for this now. Not only have I had an incredibly fulfilling career in agriculture, I actually would have been a terrible vet. After more than 20 years of horse ownership, I still get the shakes when giving needles. So when I was deciding what to study, I knew I wanted to work with animals, and agriculture seemed to be a sensible idea. It was science-based, it gave me direction, and most importantly, it provided me with a career path to follow. So I had a bit of a slow start with my career in ag, spending 2.5 years working in human pharmaceuticals. And I quickly learned this was not the career for me. But thankfully, it gave me the time and financial security to seek out my re-entry into agriculture. So in 2005, I started as a policy officer at the Australian Lot Feeders Association, analysing cattle health and welfare policy. It completely opened my eyes to the world of advocacy and public service. And it was a fantastic way to kickstart my career in the sector. I look back now and reflect on how lucky I was to have a seat at the table with some incredible leaders, from chief veterinary officers to international experts on livestock health and welfare, and my fabulous alpha counsellors. But what makes these organisations great, they're small, committed, passionate, also makes them frustrating, offering limited opportunities for progression. So in 2007, I packed my bags and moved to Canberra to work for the then Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, and now Department of Agriculture and Water Resources. My career there has been wide-ranging, which is something I love about public service. I've been fortunate to work in many areas that fulfil the department's purpose. To work with national and international governments and industry partners to grow the value of agricultural trade and reduce risk to the agricultural sector. This has included working on the National Land Care Program, Sustainable Agriculture Policy, including a career highlight, which I'm sure Alex will be happy about, developing a National Soil Research Development and Extension Strategy, water infrastructure, meat exports, Codex Alimentarius, which is a joint committee of the WHO and FAO, which improves food production and food safety internationally, as well as live animal exports and agricultural and veterinary chemicals. And I also spent a year analysing cabinet submissions, providing a rural and regional perspective to support the then Deputy Prime Minister in cabinet. There's a certain buzz in hearing government decisions on issues I've analysed, discussed on Radio National on my drive to work in the morning. But my current role has taken me in a slightly different direction, reviewing the Australian Public Service. While it doesn't sound terribly ag-related, I'm using all the policy, program and regulatory experience learned in agriculture to inform the review. And I hope that we can make my department and the entire public service better able to fulfil its legislative responsibility to serve the government, the parliament and most importantly, the people of Australia. Which brings me to a nice segue as I look into the future of agriculture. Last year, we commissioned Boston Consulting Group to undertake a scenario planning exercise. While the scenarios were developed to help us understand the potential operating environment for a future public service, I will attempt to apply an agriculture-focused lens over the findings. I will forewarn you, some of these scenarios are quite pessimistic, but they have been developed to be thought-provoking so we can best prepare for the future. So, imagine a world where the uptake and evolution of disruptive and breakthrough technologies accelerates. I am a bit of a technophile, so this future really excites me. There's huge potential for the agriculture sector to build its competitiveness through innovation, either by better understanding and adapting to the needs of the consumer or adopting new technologies. And there are plenty of ideas floating around. The Internet of Things, sensors in the field, machinery and in livestock, robotics and drones, improved data analytics, biotechnology and paddock-to-plate tracking. But the real challenge to maximise the potential of all this will be to make these stick. So how can we convince the farmer that they're worthwhile, to demonstrate that they will deliver real returns and to make products easy to use and cost effective? Oh, going the wrong way. Yeah. Okay. But what happens if Australians become more disconnected and sceptical of big institutions and are reconnecting with their local communities, buying local and relying on community services. This could be an interesting scenario for agriculture. On one hand, it might mean the reign of the big two, where Coles and Woolworths no longer hold market dominance. Could this shift market power back to the farmer, where they have the upper hand in price negotiations as deals are struck with the local butcher, greengrocer or baker, rather than centralised buyers? But how could the sector operate in such a devolved environment, especially as current trends indicate a need for better integrate and join up businesses to get improved efficiencies with greater economies of scale? And how would this affect our export markets if consumers want locally grown products from their locally grown farmers? In this scenario, our trust in institutions has rapidly declined, with increased political destabilisation due to constant changes of leadership and government. Highly personalised social media echo chambers have supplanted traditional sources of news and current affairs, resulting in polarised and partisan coverage. And people are increasingly taking control into their own hands and directly shaping policy on the issues that matter most to them. To some extent, particularly living in the Canberra bubble, this scenario appears to already be playing out, with constant leadership shuffles and the emergence of snap decisions rather than well thought through policies. The drought coverage earlier this year really hit home to me about how media frenzy, including the selection of talent rather than real evidence and analysis, drove the conversation on this very serious issue. There were so many examples of drought relief funds, GoFundMe campaigns and other avenues to help out the collective and individual farmer. While this is incredibly admirable of Australian society, it also has the potential to backfire and build resentment in the broader community as drought inevitably and unfortunately continues. What we do need is a long-term vision, data and analysis to gain a better understanding of what is happening and where, and how to take the most appropriate action. This includes finding the right support mechanisms for farmers just going through a few bad years, through to helping some farmers to have the difficult conversation about the future viability of their land and helping them to walk away with dignity where required. So in this scenario, imagine a world where political, economic, environmental and social instability accelerates. Trade wars and protectionism prevails. Tensions remain high and multinational agreements and international organisations break down. This is probably the scenario that scares me the most. Our sector is reliant on strong export markets, with more than two-thirds or around $50 billion of agricultural products exported annually. So what happens if our trading partners turn inwards? Where does the production go? And what does that mean for the farmer and the broader Australian economy? While this does paint a bleak picture, populations around the world continue to grow and there are many countries that will have to rely on imports. I hope that we can retain good relationships, a positive negotiation position and high-quality trusted products to prevent a scenario like this from affecting our sector. But moving on to something a little bit more positive. So given tomorrow is International Women's Day and this event is about celebrating women in agriculture, I wanted to finish with my experiences as a woman in this sector. I think one of the most exciting things has been studying and then working with some exceptional women. It is so wonderful seeing my peers doing amazing things while working in such diverse fields. For example, Olivia Kemp has spent her career working in some of the toughest parts of the world, delivering aid through the World Food Programme. I've followed her adventures in awe as she traversed the globe in positions based in Nepal, Pakistan, Sudan, Rome, and most recently, Southeast Asia. Natasha Hamilton is the absolute guru when it comes to thoroughbred genetics, and it is so exciting to see the culmination and celebration of her hard work as she leads the newly established Equine Genetics Research Centre based in Scone. And Alison Bentley heads the genetics and breeding program at the National Institute of Agricultural Botany in Cambridge, where she is driving genetic gain for crop improvement. This has included undertaking research in areas such as transgenics, delivering integrated crop solutions for farmers in India, Colombia, and Brazil, and supporting mid-career women in agriculture across the globe. I'm also incredibly lucky to have built my career during a period where gender parity and the need for more female leaders has been recognised and then actioned, well, at least in my little part of the workforce. The Australian Public Service has, for the first time, achieved parity at the very highest level. We currently have 9 female and 9 male secretaries leading each of our departments, with women heading traditionally male-dominated areas such as finance and foreign affairs and trade. When I first started working at the department in 2007, 42% of staff and 26% of senior executives were female. As of June 30, 2018, 51% of staff are now female, with 47% of our senior executives being women. And I had a look at our organisational chart yesterday to help inform my speech, and it currently shows that 52% of our acting and substantive senior leaders are women. It's a huge change. Huge change, and it really does, you really do see it in the department about where we've come from and how much it adds to the work that we do. But despite the good news story, women's participation in primary producer organisations continues to lag. In a quick analysis of representative bodies, using the National Farmers Federation membership as a proxy for the sector, only 18% of board members were female. 7 of the 28 organisations I reviewed had no female representation, and only 4 organisations had female chairs. Adding to this, a recent AgriFutures Australia report found that only 15% of rural companies had formal diversity strategies. Data shows us that inclusive and diverse boards are more likely to be effective boards, better able to understand their customers or stakeholders, as well as bringing fresh perspectives, new ideas and broad experiences to the table. So why aren't we seeing this play out in our sector? There is some hope for the future. The Future Farmers Network Board includes 6 young female leaders as part of its 11-person leadership team. Groups like Australian Women in Agriculture are continuing to help women influence decision-making at all levels. The AgriFutures Australia Rural Women's Award is a well-recognised source of talented women, and the National Farmers Federation now runs an annual Diversity in Agriculture Leadership Program. But this is slow progress. In an organisation that wants to change, more progress can be made by reigniting the conversation, creating a picture of success, moving from supporting to valuing flexible work arrangements, encouraging visible role models and leadership, embedding cultural change, and focusing on inclusion. But what about changing an entire industry? While I believe we absolutely require a merit-based system, do we actually need to now start introducing quotas? Should organisations such as the National Farmers Federation be taking the lead and not only setting targets for their own organisations, for themselves, but also for their member organisations? And should there be a greater focus on putting more talented women through leadership programs, such as the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation, in order to build the pipeline of capable women to fill these roles and feel comfortable and supported and able to fill these roles? While I can't change the future myself, I can lead by example. So this year, I've put the Australian Institute of Company Directors course on my list of career development goals. So maybe you will see me on a board sometime. Thank you.
Thank you, Caroline. Our final speaker this evening is Lucinda Corrigan. Lucinda has spent her professional life working in innovation across the livestock industries. Through many roles at a local, state and national level, she has developed a deep interest in the ethical governance of public funds, transparency and accountability that enable change. She was named the WIAA Agribusiness Leader in 2014 and in 2016 and was honoured to receive the Professional Achievement Award from the University of Sydney's Faculty of Agriculture. Please welcome Lucinda Corrigan.
Thank you. Well, it's wonderful to follow on from Evie and Caroline, and I hope I can add a different perspective after 40 years of working in the industry. And thank you very much, Alex, to you and your team for the invitation. There is something pretty fabulous about being asked back to your alma mater nearly 40 years later. Excuse me, glasses call me. If I look like I'm enjoying myself, the answer is definitely yes. Incidentally, I was chuffed to learn this week that alma mater literally means beautiful mother in Latin. It's an interesting reflection from a 17th century thinker who first used the term, possibly well ahead of some parts of the big world that is agriculture. So I'm going to talk tonight, I'm going to go high and then I'm going to go low, and we're going to sort of zoom around a bit with some stories. In the early 2000s, I was chairing the advisory committee of the CRC for beef quality. We had these annual meetings that went through the research program and interrogated program leaders. It was a good process, me and the boys, the captains of industry. On this particular day, we were gathered with a wider group of stakeholders. I will call him Doug. He walked in and said, I don't do female chairs. Right, I said. Well, I've got a lot to get through, so we'll park that till the end of the meeting. We proceeded. There were people on teleconference phones and those in the room, including presenters. I asked Doug at the end of the meeting what he'd like to do about it, and he said, well, you didn't go too badly. Most women my age have these stories. I have quite a few of them. My early career was punctuated by working harder, being the best prepared, conscientiously doing the follow-up. Even so, it didn't always guarantee a seat at the table. The agribusiness community, whether public or private, corporate or small and medium enterprise, has suffered from not being inclusive of 50% of the population. I think academia is possibly ahead of some other sectors. So moving to... I'll just check where my first photos come from. I don't have many photos. You know, I grew up in the non-digital age, and it's amazing how few photos I have of those early years hanging around horses and things. I had a background on a sheep station in the Western Riverina. My mother educated me till I was 8, and then I went to the local school and finally to boarding school. My father died 50 years ago this year of asthma. We moved to Sydney, but I always wanted to work in agriculture. It was a classic story of agriculture in the 1970s. The first wave of rural reconstruction hit hard after the soldiers' settlement blocks after the Second World War. In thinking about ag, it was definitely that influence of my early life. So I commenced ag science, sorry girls, in 1976 when university was free. I was one of those rare students who'd been accepted into vet science and decided I wanted to work with healthy animals, not sick ones. It was in the days before the notion of herd health. It was a great choice. The intake was about a third female and two-thirds male, a large cohort from the state agricultural high schools, which were boys only at the time, Farrer, Hurlston and James Roos. First year was punctuated with many highlights. I could not mention tonight Dr. Bruce Davison, who taught a wonderful encompassing subject called agriculture and the economy. With his eccentric gestures and constant motion, he kept us enthralled with his knowledgeable overview of this iconic industry, its history, socio-political culture, and scattered in there were the follies. Who can forget the northern myth? He had a great story. There are three ways to get on the land: patrimony, matrimony, or parsimony. We loved it. Oh gosh, I'm going back. So here we are in Camden in 1970. Don't you just love the Lady Di dresses? That's me down the bottom sitting between Dr. Liz Kernahan and Professor Frank Croft. Liz herself was a trailblazer. She was a doctor in dairy nutrition, I think. She went on and served the local council for many years, and then she became a member of the Legislative Council, I think for 13 years. Frank was also a bit of a trailblazer in the whole sustainable development of sustainable agriculture, and he took us up to his property at Bathurst. Not so politically correct, called Blackfellas Creek. And we had a wonderful weekend up there in fourth year. So we had these annual trips organised by Dennis DeCanso. Fabulous to see Dennis here tonight. And then we got to third year. I chose animal husbandry, and we got into the subject that really lit our fuses. The wonderful teachers, Professor Rex Butterfield, who became a lifelong friend and correspondent, Professor Terry Robinson, Dr. Steve Salomon, and then in fourth year, the wonderful Frank Nicholas, up the back, who taught quantitative genetics. We adored Frank and his subject in equal amounts. I also thought about the women who lectured us, and who could forget Dr. Edith Lees in biochemistry or Dr. Jane Libholtz in poultry. I spent most of the 80s in the emerging Kashmir fibre industry and was CEO of the Australian Kashmir Growers Association in my 20s. My first reflection is about career planning. My female role models, incredibly accomplished, were all single and didn't have children. Betty Archdale was captain of the British cricket team. She became director of Women's College here at Sydney University and then was headmistress of the school I went to. Jill Kerr-Conway had a fantastic academic career both in Australia and America and ended up being head of one of the most prestigious colleges over there. And of course, Dr. Helen Newton-Turner, whom I knew about as a little girl on a merino station and was one of the leading quantitative geneticists in the merino industry. My story is one about taking opportunities as they appeared rather than thinking about them beforehand. When I'm asked my advice from young people these days, which is pretty often, I ask them some questions. Where do you want to make a difference? Do you want to work in the commercial or corporate sector? Have you thought about an international experience? If you chose government or academia in your early career, be aware of the choices you may or may not have later on. It is quite unusual to make a mid-career change from a public or academic position to private enterprise, although perhaps it is happening more now than it was in the past. The reverse is more common in my experience. And then, of course, there are industry associations and SMEs and so on. I was particularly lucky to enter a newly emerging industry, the Kashmir fibre industry, in the early 1980s. Lucky because it was new, and there was not the entrenched traditionalism of many older industries. There were many entrepreneurial women who flew planes, did the stock work, marketing, and didn't see barriers to entry, leadership or business. So this is me, sort of straight out of university, in my technical officer role with Kinross Kashmir Company. The picture down the bottom is actually Foray Island off the west coast of Monkey Mia, where we went catching goats off Foray and Bernier Islands. And field days, up the top is Fred Moylan. Fred Moylan started the mohair industry in Australia and then moved on and started the Kashmir industry. And we used to run field days all over Australia with Fred through those years. And my next picture is a classic, and for those who are about the time, we used to hold field days every year at Kinross, and some years 1,000 people came along. They were big days. In the back row, for those who know agri-politicians of the past, is David Asmus on the left-hand side, and some of the big wigs of agricultural appointments, which was the consultancy company involved. And in the front row, the gentleman with sort of looking very debonair was Sir Alan Smith, who flew Spitfires in the Second World War and absolutely took no prisoners, but he was a marvellous person to know. And he was CEO of Dawson International in Scotland. As CEO of an industry organisation, it was a steep learning curve, but we were able to develop a different sort of service based on knowledge and innovation. We ran a national R&D program partnering with the purchaser of the fibre, Kinross, and importantly, we focused on the product and not just the animals. Since 1986, I've been a partner in a family Angus genetics business in the southern New South Wales. We are based on properties at Bona in the Murray Valley between Albury and Holbrook, and in the Billabong Creek catchment at Culcairn. Family business is a great ride if you can make it work. It's all about the team, building technical skills, business acumen, making decisions in the difficult times like now, and innovating. The key pieces for us have been business management, growth and risk, finance and investing. In recent times, we've been involved with succession planning in our fifth generation family business. The transfer of assets is not trivial. At the centre is helping the next generation to understand that the land and the cows are not a cash cow. We strive to achieve best practice succession, which requires frequent communication and loads of goodwill. And needless to say, our daughter and sons will be treated the same. So that's the team at home. It's a couple of people have changed since then, but as you can see, Brian and I at the front. That's our daughter Ruth up top on the left-hand side, and our son Anthony just at the second row, smiling. So we're very lucky that two out of our three children are farming with us. We've grown the size of the business from a small-scale 1 FTE to one with scale. Scale gives choice and enables those within the business to specialise. We now run about 3,500 head of cattle on 4,000 hectares with some adjustment. We run a team that's 50-50, including two of our children, and Ruth has a COO role in addition to managing the breeding. And my second reflection is, while the promise of the 1980s was diversification, the mantra of being in a family agribusiness now is to specialise and to do what you do very well and profitably. Well, there we are. I thought I'd better show you a couple of pictures of cows, just so you know there are some. So this is bringing some spring calving cows down the hill just a couple of months ago for weaning. And the reason I want to show you this was every calf that's born now has 50,000 pieces of data within about 3 months of age. So we are now doing genomics. So that's taking a DNA sample at birth on the day they're born. And so we are now starting to develop, we're able to make more accurate selection decisions at a young age. And that goes for the best animals in the drop, but also the ones at the bottom end. And this is, of course, where we are now. This is 1,000 weaners on feed at Culcairn. So we have a drought lot over there, and those cattle will stay in that drought lot until it rains. Let's hope that happens soon. My main roles off farm have been in research, development and innovation, first working at a regional, state and then national level. These have included 4 CRCs in beef and natural resource management, Commissioner of ACR for a couple of terms, 9 years at Meat and Livestock Australia, chairing the advisory committee at the Graham Centre for Agricultural Innovation at Charles Sturt University, and so on. They've centred around sustainable farming systems, including climate, soils and pastures, genetics and genomics, supply chain innovation. I was also fortunate to be asked to chair the previous Primary Industries Minister in New South Wales, Katrina Hodgkinson's Advisory Council. Her team gave us an interesting body of work, and she relied on our advice for the difficult decisions. It was immensely rewarding, and we developed a trusting relationship. Currently, I have a number of roles, including Chair of the Animal Welfare Science Centre at Melbourne Uni. I'm a non-executive director of an emerging ag tech company called Agisense, which is developing virtual fencing and virtual herding technology developed by the CSIRO and taking that to market. I'm a non-executive director of Datagene, the company that provides genetic improvement to Australia's dairy industry. So when we're asked to think about the future of agriculture, the future of agriculture, of course, is the future of food. Food supply chains are changing rapidly, and I think Evie gave a great description of some of the challenges that our food supply chains have. They're changing quickly, connecting digitally, using data up and down to improve consumer experience. As the millennials become the most important consumers globally, they have greater needs, connection to the source, societal expectations, reduced environmental footprint, and that's alongside our traditional concerns of safety, price and quality. The future is collaborative and data-driven. Agriculture is at the fourth technical revolution. We've been through the agrarian revolution 10,000 years ago, the industrial revolution in the 17 to early 1800s. Then we had the technical revolution with computers, the internet, which brought massive changes to the working conditions. And now we're really in that fourth digital revolution: storage and processing, automation, artificial intelligence, which will displace workers from jobs and a wide range of professions. So what will that mean for a career in agriculture? What qualifications and knowledge will be needed to cope with the future of work? Much will depend on the economics of collecting and analysing data. And that's a subject I could go on about for quite some time. It is 11 years since the introduction of the smartphone, and you can look at what's changed in that time. At a business level, a background and detail in science will be increasingly irrelevant. Google makes everything accessible. Although, of course, it is important that the knowledge is gathered in institutions like this. So now we have apps for everything at our fingertips, integrated software, machine learning. Detailed technical understanding becomes redundant at a business level, and workers need to be more flexible and change. It's more important than the knowledge itself. So the skills that are required are really about people skills, they're soft skills. And so that will lead to a much greater role of females in the workplace, because female skills will come to the fore and the gender imbalance will change. That's my prediction. We'll see, so with women in agriculture, we will see leadership that enables new ways of working together. Personal skills will be elevated by the need to use soft skills to solve complex problems. And working in teams, where all views are valued. I look back at the hierarchical industry that I joined 40 years ago. That way of working is now irrelevant. I was approached to do a job by New South Wales Farmers in the early 90s and then told by the CEO that I was not well known and not the wife of a general counsellor. In 2006, I led a bid for a CRC centred at the University of Western Australia, the Future Farm CRC, which followed on from the CRC for salinity. It was at a time when the Cooperative Research Centre program was changing to skills-based boards from representative boards. One of my fellow directors was Dr. Tim Healy, an economist who'd been a high-level Treasury official and chaired audit and risk on a couple of top 200 companies. Tim and I would walk together, chewing the fat before meetings. He introduced me to the concept of hagiology. It's the literature dealing with the lives and legends of saints. Now stay with me. Where is she going? Stay with me. Agriculture is beset by people seeking silver bullets and those who think they have all the answers. Hot subjects are soil carbon and regenerative agriculture. Hot topics because they're not open to examination and often free of evidence. Self-appointed experts who think they have all the answers. They fit nicely into Tim's description. Many of them love to be deified. The second part of this is the inference of anti-science and pseudoscience. The release last year of The Call of the Reed Warbler by Charles Massey is a case of a saviour suggesting he has all the answers. For many of us who have spent much of our farming lifetime looking for better ways to run our businesses that have triple bottom line outcomes for the people, the land, the livestock, and be profitable at the same time, this is a bit of an anathema. The CSIRO review of the book points out the very thin evidence behind the claims of significant improvements in productivity and NRM. The lack of attribution to 3 decades of land care and the advances we've made collectively in biodiversity, moisture retention, erosion control are mind-boggling. It took till about page 400 to mention a woman who had contributed to the advances he advocates. In my 30-plus years in land care, there have been a plethora of women thinking, caring and doing. I look forward to the time when there are as many women commentators as men around the industry. I've seen some significant improvements in the area I call thought leadership. But it will benefit from this balance, not because they are women, but because they add a different perspective. I hope we move beyond the tribal conversations of the past and able to work in what we have in common, and communication skills are at the centre of a less adversarial discourse. Oh, I wanted to tell you about Tadera. Tadera was a very exciting low-rainfall legume that we worked on in the Future Farm CRC, and it is actually now coming to market, and this is a sort of a 15-year journey. So it's one of those classic cases of staying the journey to really create change in agricultural farming systems. In my community role chairing Farmers for Climate Action, I work with a young and very capable team. We're sort of yin and yang. They've taught me a lot, agile and flexible ways of working. I add the corporate knowledge of how agriculture works, relationships, and the right decision at the right time. We don't think about gender, but it seems to work. And we have a big challenge ahead of us this year. Finally, I see the legacy my daughter inherits as she moves into the COO role in our business, as well as running the breeding program. Recently, she completed the Rabobank Farm Managers course. In 2018, she was still the only female actively managing a farm business on the course. Change is slow, but we will eventually get there. Thank you.
Lucinda. Thank you very much. Wonderful. Yeah, Lucinda, if you could stay up here, and if we'll invite our other two panelists to come and join us. We're going to have a Q&A time now, and I'll kick off with a couple of questions, but while I'm doing that, if you'd like to think of some things to ask the panel, we'll move to that in a moment. Thank you for your stories. It's really wonderful to hear the things that you had to share. Thank you. One of the things I noticed was that in all your stories, they could have just been regular human stories. There wasn't particularly uniquely feminine or different about them because you were a woman. How do you guys feel on an everyday basis today when you're at work? Are you conscious of being a woman, or is it just about doing your job like a regular person? Anyone can answer.
I can start with that. My short answer is no. I have a very even workforce. It's who's the best person for the job, and that's a really wonderful place to be in. But I reflect on it a little bit and think about how I've grown, and I feel like I've had to work a lot harder than the boys to make my point heard or make myself known. I've had to dress better. I've had to be more well prepared. I've had to have better arguments when I've come into the room so that I can have that voice and get it out there. So while I work in a very fantastic work environment, I still think I've had to work harder, but I also think that that has potentially helped my career. So it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Great.
I think I'm pretty lucky because I work in an environment where we do have a really forward-thinking inclusion and diversity policy. And I guess at the corporate level that I'm lucky to be a part of such an environment. But I also am lucky that I work in a team that we have more women than men already. I'm lucky that I'm surrounded by pretty cool women already. So I don't think I've ever stopped to think about my small little team and how we fit together like that. But I guess looking at the industry, as a young person, I still go to events where more than half the room are males, old white men who sit at the conference tables around me. And I think that there is a long way to go still.
I think that it's different depending on where you are in sort of agriculture and agribusiness around the country. So I think if you're in some blue collar workplaces are still pretty tough for women. I think there's change happening. Shearing sheds in those places, there's definitely change happening. But Dr. Skye Saunders, who did that Whispers from the Bush, the book that was released I think last year or the year before from ANU, did tell some pretty chilling stories about women in, I guess, more remote workplaces and just still being a pretty tough gig. Having said that, I've seen a massive change in my working life, so I don't see that as a sort of a long-term problem in a sort of a leadership sense or dealing with other professionals.
Excellent. That's good. Evie, you had a great quote in one of your images. You need a doctor, a dentist, but you need a farmer 3 times a day. Did anyone else notice that and think that was brilliant? Yeah. Please, someone make a bumper sticker of that. It's fantastic. The image of agriculture in the mind of a lot of city dwellers is increasingly misinformed, and I think we've all been frustrated in the last few months just seeing the media coverage and thinking that's not really what it's like. How do you think the stories that you've told us tonight as women in agriculture, which would probably surprise a lot of city dwellers, how do you think those stories can be used to get in under the walls of misinformation and help change the impressions of the sector?
I'll go if you want. It's my photo. credit to my mum there, actually. She took the photo of the board, and we actually can't remember where we saw it. So there you go. It's on a chalkboard outside a cafe somewhere. I think education is one of the most important things, and I think that there is an opportunity for us to get agriculture as part of the conversation with young people, particularly in urban environments, at a young age. I'm lucky that I went to a school where I could pursue that, but I graduated in a cohort of 9 students in ag class in year 12 at a school with 250 people in my year. I think also that there's an opportunity for us to really champion what agriculture is, to tell the good stories, because there are so many, and to really capture our audience of uneducated consumers of food about the benefits of eating locally, of eating Australian-made produce, of understanding where their food comes from. And I think that we have a role in helping to communicate that message and ensuring that everyone really does understand where their food comes from.
Mm. So there's quite a bit of literature right now and longitudinal data that trust in institutions and trust more generally across Australian society is declining, and the way to address that is to engage, to tell the stories, to make it real, to make it personal. We're seeing this in the public service, you know, openness of government, getting our data out there, you know, not hiding behind our politicians or the walls. So I think there's a real opportunity for the sector to get their stories out and to tell the real stories. And I look at my purchasing habits, and I've got some friends who own vineyards. Very lucky to have friends that own vineyards. But they also benefit from that because I'm an incredibly loyal customer. So that's just my personal experience on one little part of the sector. If I can see, and I know they produce well, they're passionate, they're committed, they really love the industry, and that's what takes me back to their products. So if our farmers can get that message out there and get that personalisation, and I think technology will actually help us even more, like we already see with Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, that you can tell your story far more easily than 10 years ago. So I think, yeah, getting stories out there, I think we'll get that trust and help society realise that agriculture is wonderful.
I was on the board of Meat Livestock Australia when the live export trade was closed in 2011, and I have to say that was quite a pivotal experience in terms of understanding, you know, an industry in crisis. And if I look at the cotton industry now and just the misinformation and the vitriol, if you just have a little look on Twitter, it's dreadful. I personally think that this is a high-level strategic project, and NFF have certainly taken it on. It will be all about resourcing and about really understanding. People really need to understand what the consumer and society thinks of farming and sort of work backwards instead of thinking, oh, we just have to give the messages and they'll pick it up and they'll understand, and it's not really going to be like that. It's going to be a much more, I guess, deliberate and long-term piece of work to actually develop greater trust with the Australian community. And obviously every industry has its bugbears. So for dairy, it's bobby calves. You know, in the northern industry, it's dehorning the 6 months of age. There are practices that we have to find ways, and we're, you know, pushing that innovation button as hard as we can to you know, dehorn cattle, you know, not just genetically, but perhaps in other ways that will enable us to work at a level which the public accepts. And that is certainly, you know, I think the animal industries probably have more challenges than perhaps cropping. But although the current, you know, discourse over cotton and rice is perhaps evidence that they're under just as much pressure from the community.
Mm. And what role do you think social media will play in this? Do you think that's part of the A-level strategy, or that's the B-level and there's something else that we should be doing as an agriculture industry to get really engaged heart and minds where it matters? Because Twitter is a scary space. It's good and bad.
Look, I think it's part of the story, but I think there is a whole lot of work going on with, you know, with chefs, with champions, with... If I look at the work we're doing in climate change, for instance, there's a whole lot of pieces of work we need to do. We need to work with politicians, we need to work with the community, and so on. So it's not just a simple answer, but, I mean, social media will obviously be part of that communication.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think social media is definitely going to be the be-all and end-all, but it's definitely becoming a more successful tool. A couple of friends of mine participated in the NFF Young Leaders program last year and made some little Lego characters that are seen all over YouTube. Mm. See, everybody knows them, and they're also on Instagram. And it's interesting because someone at work said to me the other day, oh, they're cute Lego things that this little lady was carrying around. And I said, oh yeah, they're part of the This Is Oz Ag, it's an NFF initiative. And they had no idea, but they'd just seen them on Instagram. So it also works, which is really important, I think, too.
And I think it's really useful, but it depends on how far your reach can be, and I think there's issues in terms of the algorithms that Instagram and the various social media channels use. It's actually harder now to get your message out than when, say, Instagram first started, where you could get lots of followers very easily. So there's a bit of technology in there playing, stifling the opportunity in this space, but you know, it is what it is. But I think social media plays an interesting role in terms of engaging with the traditional media sources. So with a lot of the drought coverage, you saw in the initial stories were so negative and basically pulling out the worst of the worst. And on social media, people started saying, hey, that's actually not my story. Mm-hmm. And it was only with that call out that then you started to see the stories shift and change. And the national media started picking up those stories. And I think I watched an episode of The Project where, one week they'd been incredibly critical of a cotton farmer who'd been using water, and so there were images from the sky, and then probably 2 weeks later they had this poor cotton farmer on saying, no, we've used our water allocation that we've got. We're actually having a really horrible year. Just because it looks green doesn't mean that we're using our water. So there was a little bit of a mea culpa at that point from the traditional media sources to go, okay, we put these things out there, but then it's followed up and they see what's happening on social media and they can actually go then and tell the real story. So it plays a bit of a picture, and it plays a useful picture, and I follow lots of farms on Instagram and I love it, so.
That's great. I've got many more questions, but does anyone else want to ask something? Just pop your hand up. Someone down the front and a couple around the side.
I'll go pretty loud voice, so we'll see how it goes. Georgie again. I have the pleasure of working with Evie every day at KPMG, and I also know Lucinda, so lovely to hear Lucinda's story again. And I just want to touch, Lucinda, I think, on a point that you raised around Ruth's recent experience in the Rabobank program as the only female farmer in the room. And we've seen progression in the sector around women in advocacy roles. So Georgie Somerset in Queensland, fabulous to see Fiona Simpson, take on the first female presidency of the National Farmers Federation. But I think the point around women still identifying themselves as farmers, the number of women in farmer advocacy groups. And so what do you think we need to do to start to change that in the sector? And very interested, I mean, Caroline, you did your own statistics, but maybe deep dive into that a little bit more, Lucinda.
Look, I think when we look at agri-political, and I'll just take my organisation, which is New South Wales Farmers, we've been a member forever. We don't go to meetings because they just need to modernise the processes. That's the first thing I'd say. I think the idea of having to go to a local meeting and then a district meeting and then a state meeting, and it just comes from another era. And I just think people who own and run businesses now are so time poor that it has to be a lot more useful. Than, I mean, we run Farmers for Climate Action. We've got a board member in every state nearly, one in Queensland, two in Western Australia. And we do nearly everything on Zoom, which is fantastic. We can see each other, and we get together once a year because we're budget's limiting. But I do think they need to find much more modern ways of harvesting people's concerns rather than sort of making this sort of physical rolling up. I know my two children in the farming business aren't interested in agri-politics, so, they're interested in innovation, they're interested in going where all the young people go and what they're doing, and as long as there's a barbecue and a beer afterwards, everything's good. So, yeah, finding the model that attracts them, but I think a lot of it will be about asking, the next generation how they'd like to do this, because these things are important. At the end of the day, we need to develop competency in our farm leaders. I just listened to Fiona Simpson speak, and I think, she is so eloquent, so articulate. She can, Q&A, she just blows me away. She's just so good at it. And we obviously need to train people to be able to do that, because there's no doubt, there are people like Fiona who can really articulate to urban audiences the issues and the complexity and make it real. And I think that is really important, that we find the way to train more people to do that. So don't really have an easy answer for you, but I do think that a lot of what happens in agri-political organisations is really based on models that are about 40 years old.
Hi, I'm Kate Trotter. I'm from the Australian Farm Institute. Lucinda, you touched a bit on the divide between how us girls in the city, like I work at the AFI and we've got, I think we're about 99% female. What advice do you give to someone who is working in a blue collar industry? Like, I've got a friend who's an agronomist who is just up against it every single day. What advice do you give to girls that aren't as lucky as us, who, you know, face sexism issues, who face all sorts of things every day, and they're not that far out of Sydney?
Well, the first thing I think is that they really need to build a very strong and powerful support network. I just think that's absolutely critical, because if you have, you can start calling this behaviour out. And I can think of many times in my career when I should have called it out and I didn't, and that's fine. I mean, you know, I'm strong, I survived, that's fine. But I think there's nothing worse than being a young woman in those roles and feeling like you're being constantly put down. So I would really look to, there will be a support network in the local community, and you need to find the ways to find those people and really get them to help you deal with it. They'll be your think tank, and I'm sure she'll be able to do that. But that is terrible to think. 2019, God.
Do any of you guys want to add to that?
It's interesting because I think I haven't got to work in the field that much, but I think from my perspective, being a young person, that when I do get the opportunity to be out, you know, on farm, is to have confidence that you know your stuff as well, you know. Have courage and be proud that you know what you do. And if you need to, make sure that you, like you've said, Lucinda, raise the issue. Don't be afraid to stand up for yourself. I think that that's important. And, you know, that comes from a confidence thing, and it can be hard, but sometimes the tough conversations are the best conversations in the end.
And I really reiterate on building your networks, and it doesn't necessarily have to be someone within your community itself. It's someone to talk to, someone to talk through the issues. How do I address this? How do I deal with this issue? What can I do? What can I make this better? And, you know, so many women, myself included, we suffer from things like imposter syndrome. We never think we're good enough. We really struggle to, when asked to speak at something like this or do something different, it's like, oh, no, I'm not good enough. Like, oh, why am I being asked? So there's so many resources out there for women these days, and I was listening to a wonderful podcast driving up to Sydney last night called The Pineapple Project, which just goes through all those issues that women face in the workplace. And, yeah, it's, you know, your friend is working in a very different environment, but the techniques that they talk through in those sorts of situations are so useful. And every time I listen to it, I'm like, yep, yep, yep. So, you know, find your networks, find the resources, and just be confident, and you can do it.
Great. Great insight. I think we've got time for one more.
Hi, ladies. Thanks for sharing. My name is Jason Bradley. I'm the director of Smart Ag at Olds College in Olds, Alberta, Canada. And we're myself and a couple colleagues are here visiting your country to find out what you're doing so well in ag innovation, both in academics and applied research. And so my question for the panel is, listen, you talked about a couple different technologies, genomics and virtual fencing, for instance. I'm just wondering what you think might be the most promising specific technology or perhaps technology area in terms of agriculture production, whether it's livestock or cropping. Thank you.
There's such a plethora of digital startups and technologies at the moment. From where I sit in the cattle industry, there's the technologies are related to the animal itself. So this virtual herding technology is being the algorithm's being written into a collar, and there's a little solar panel on the back. And eventually, not only will it do virtual fencing and virtual herding, but it'll also do all that sort of animal health and welfare type collection of data as well, so that you'll get early signs of, especially, well, in the dairy industry, I think they already have it in terms of early signs of mastitis and so on. So I think that suite of technologies, in terms of what the farmer needs, and if I were to ask Pete Murdoch here and other people in the room who actually are, you know, boots on their, dirt on their boots farmers, our agricultural consultant at WAGA said a few years ago, you know, the most useful thing would be more accurate assessment of available pasture. This is for the livestock industry. So how can we, instead of having to go out and measure every paddock, or and we had the pastures from space technology 15 years ago, and that hasn't really delivered for all sorts of reasons. And now I think with the advances in digital, we will see that technology move forward pretty quickly, and I'm confident that we will get to a stage where we have much better assessment for, you know, target animal weights and so on, all the things we need to do. So I'm not sure if that answers your question particularly. What I think is the livestock industry is a fair way behind growing crops, you know, variable rate technology and all the sort of GPS systems that they've had for 15 years plus. And so we're playing pretty rapid catch-ups. And I think with all these things, the trick is not to go to market too early. So when I was on the board of Meat and Livestock Australia, we had a preg testing gadget called ePreg, which was going to revolutionise the northern cattle industry. And all you had to do was place it here and, you know, send out some I think they were laser beams, and, you know, you'd work out if a cow was pregnant or not in a couple of seconds, and that would, you know, solve all the problems about, you know, carrying empty cows and so on. And you know, didn't ever deliver the accuracy it needed, but we went to market too early, and it turned, you can turn people off innovation if you go to market too early. So we said, oh, this thing's coming, but actually it didn't. And then we sort of had to, you know, close down the project. So I think this is quite a tricky time in terms of all these innovations are being developed, but trying to get, you know, the best bets to market as fast as we can without turning people off because they don't work. So there's a bit of a trick there.
Good question. I guess putting my consultant hat on, that's the question we get asked all the time. What solution is going to be the answer to our problems? And sometimes I think we'd love to know ourselves. I guess I'm a young upstart who's interested in the glitz and the glam of the industry, and something that we're working on a lot is around blockchain solutions and around how we can use blockchain to better build both trust and provenance in the supply chain, but also to drive traceability and productivity. But I think some of the biggest challenges that we see across industries and those that we're working with is not necessarily that the technology is not there or that the solution's not available, it's that the primary producer isn't ready to buy in, or they're not talking to the next person in their supply chain, and the supply chain players aren't connected, and then the end consumer doesn't get to know about it either. So it's actually not necessarily that the solution's not there, it's that we're too fragmented to pull it together yet. And that's a unique conundrum that we're kind of grappling with still.
It's a very curly question because there's so much is going through my head right now. So from a technology perspective, I really like some of the work that some of the big cattle companies are doing around integrating their systems. So that they collect data from the paddock through to the abattoir from the different properties that they go through. And I think there's real opportunities, and yes, there's a certain amount of data that you can collect along that supply chain at this point in time. But if you can create a system that's modular, so you can create widgets to add and add and add and add, so that it's something that's not static at a point in time, it actually evolves and can change and can give you greater bits of information and data and data points and ways to make your business better and more effective along that supply chain, I think that is a really interesting space that could provide a lot of potential in the industry, particularly in those big cattle stations. From putting my government hat on, I think an innovation that will help us is better building regulation to cope with innovation. So more recently I was working in agricultural and veterinary chemicals legislation, and it's really difficult to actually regulate in the biotechnology space because it just keeps changing. So how can you build a regulatory structure to ensure that the safety of humans, the safety of the environment, animals, the safety of our trade operating environment where the goalposts keep changing, and you've got a regulatory framework that is so hard to shift, and so it takes so much time and so much political will. So are there innovations in how we build our regulatory system to actually better cope with new technologies so that they can come into the system and be jumped on and used as effectively and as quickly as possible to provide the sector good wins?
Fantastic. I think we all agree they were fantastic insights and really well done, guys. Can we please say a big thank you to our panel? You can stay there if you want. Thanks very much. So just to close off the evening, I'd like to remind everyone of a few future events to be held by the Sydney Institute of Agriculture. On Friday the 21st of June, the University of Sydney will host the SunFix Symposium, which is an annual meeting for researchers interested in legume biology and rhizobia. On Wednesday the 3rd of July, the Sydney Institute of Agriculture will present its research symposium on animal agriculture this year. On September 18, up in Narrabri, the campus throws open its doors to hundreds of stakeholders for its annual field day. And then in December, we will be holding the Science and Technology Engineering Economics, or STEDA conference, on the 3rd to the 5th of December. Further details of all these events and more can be found on the SIA website. Can we please now once more just thank our speakers and our panel, and then we will retire to the back for some food. Thank you. Thank you.